Welcome to Art Laws. I'm Alex Zappa.
And I'm Robin Rosenthal. Art Laws is a podcast that explores cultural outlaws, both present and past, from artists and filmmakers to musicians and writers. Eric Fischel is one of the most influential painters of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Inspired by his own middle-class upbringing on Long Island, Fischel's provocative paintings expose the underbelly of American suburban life, while piercing through its veil. Through startling scenes of grief, adolescent sexuality, and political malaise, Fischel is committed to expressing what often remains hidden and unspoken behind society's mores.
During his meteoric rise in the 1980s, in an era when art eschewed figuration and the human body, Fischel embraced it. His paintings boldly explore the body in all of its movement, gesture, and form. By imbuing his large-scale canvases with a psychological intensity, Fischel's work invites us to examine our own relationship with taboos, internal conflict, and complacency. Fischel's paintings, sculptures, and drawings have been the subject of numerous solo and major group exhibitions around the world. And his work is represented in major museum collections, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art, MoMA, the Whitney Museum of American Art, and MoCA in LA. His memoir, Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas, was published by Crown in 2013.
A longtime resident of Sag Harbor, Long Island, Eric's recent venture has been to renovate and transform a local church into an artist residency, exhibition space, and creative center, known fittingly as The Church. We welcome Eric Fischel to Art Laws. So I grew up in the suburban Midwest in the late 60s. And when I came to New York in the 80s as a student of Parsons School of Design, I saw your early shows at Mary Boone and your retrospective at the Whitney, and your paintings spoke to me. They were relatable and arresting and revelatory because they pierced through the veil of this pristine suburban life and exposed its underbelly. And everything that everyone was covering up and no one wanted to talk about or look at, you were looking at. So what were you attempting to explore and work out in your paintings with these suburban themes of appearance versus reality?
Well, first of all, to say something about the suburbs, which is a place I also grew up in. I grew up there kind of at the beginning of this suburbanization of America, a post-war sense of a kind of an ideal or idyllic environment, for a healthy, upwardly mobile, something that was safe for children to be a part of, et cetera, et cetera. It was really part of the American dream concept. And it was also something that within the art world, it was never considered to be of great significance in terms of content, that it was basically a superficial environment. And so there hadn't been really, to some extent, in literature and movies preceding the 70s, which is when me and my generation came into being, the art world had absolutely dismissed that as something of valuable content. Ironically, my generation, most of us grew up in the suburbs. And so we knew that, in fact, it was riddled with content. It was sick with content. So part of my impetus was to try to draw on that resource, which was based on experience. Mm-hmm. I guess at the time, a lot of things were changing in the art world. There was a breakdown of the hegemony of minimalism and capitalism and purism, philosophical purity, et cetera, stylistic rigor in terms of formalism, all those kind of things were breaking down as pluralism was becoming a reality, a dominant force. Mm-hmm. I think I remember most of my peers, so, you know, young artists coming out of school, scrambling to try to find a voice, find what it is and how to embrace and how to develop and all of that kind of struggle. And for me, it was set against a backdrop of insecurity. I didn't feel I had the intellectual rigor to defend myself against the conceptual framework of modernism. So I began to look for what couldn't be taken away from me through argument or dismissal. So I took a while to get to it, but basically where I came from became the truth about me. And so that's what I began to explore and to develop. So that early work was, you know, absolutely focused on the contradictions of the ideal and the dysfunctional. And that's what you saw.
Well, yeah.
It's funny, you know, you talk in your book about growing up in suburban Long Island, which is where I grew up as well. And you talk about this experiencing this dual reality. On the outside, your family presented this middle class country club exterior, but on the inside, there was violence and chaos. And that it was something that you had to keep hidden. And I'm just wondering, how did that sort of navigate the way you existed in your early life?
Well, first of all, where on Long Island did you grow up?
I grew up on the South Shore in this little town called Atlantic Beach, which is near Lido Beach, Long Beach.
Sure, of course. We used to go surfing over in that area.
Yeah.
So you're asking me, how did I survive?
That's exactly it.
That, of course, is the content of many, many years of therapy. So, you know, trying to understand exactly what that experience was in terms of the impact of it, because it was a very wounding, very complicated reality, not unfamiliar to a lot of people, unfortunately. But what I discovered as I began to make art was the complex relationship that we have towards images that represent or are supposed to represent our deepest needs and desires, right? And so part of the sort of expressive strategy was to show moments that feel like something significant is taking place, something impactful, something even dire is taking place, and the objects that one surrounds themselves with is not delivering the needed either comfort or protection or elevation or whatever it is that we've invested in them. I don't think that quite answers your question, which I probably can't answer on a personal level, but terms of an art strategy, that's the way I was. It wasn't even that I was thinking about it. I was discovering it.
Right.
In that way. So probably if I'd thought about it, I would have thought second about it, thinking, maybe I don't want to go down this road.
Let's discuss your painting Sleepwalker from 1979. This was a pivotal painting that was defining for you, even to yourself as an artist. Can you describe this painting to our listeners and how it came about in terms of process? What were you thinking about when you painted it?
I don't start a painting knowing what I want to paint, certainly not knowing where it's going to go. I start with, and all my paintings are collage based, putting images together in some way and then trying to blend them in a way so it looks like they all fit in the same space at the same time, barely. But nonetheless, that you kind of accept that as a reality. So I'm not exactly sure in terms of my memory right now what I started out with in Sleepwalker, but the image that the viewer would see, the finished image, is of a naked boy, maybe 10, 11 years old, back turned towards the viewer, doing something that, in terms of body language, it looks like The kid could be masturbating or peeing. He's standing in a kiddie pool, ankle deep in a kiddie pool, a circular kiddie pool, out in a backyard. There are two lawn chairs that are almost like an audience witness to whatever it is he's doing. And the whole scene is sort of caught in a spotlight that fades to blackness very quickly on the edges. So it gives you a sense that this is something illuminated by a nighttime light. It's taking place outside. And I called it Sleepwalker because it seemed like something where this child was kind of the question of why was he there? Why was he in this pool? Why was he outside doing something that might be, not might be, but was certainly considered private? What was going on? And I thought, he's not conscious yet. And so he's sleepwalking. And he's acting out a truth, but he's not yet fully understanding what that truth is. Mm-hmm. And part of the thing of even bringing into a kind of public discussion the topic of masturbation, especially in relationship to a boy, because I'm a man, was about recognizing transitions as profoundly significant in a child's life. You have birth, of course, and learning to walk or speak or et cetera, beginning separations, parental separation, et cetera. And then at a certain point, you begin to discover your body and have a relationship with that, or, you know, try to figure out what it is and what it needs and what you need with it, et cetera, et cetera. That is what that painting centers around. And I think the chairs were the last to go in. And I think they represent to me a kind of absence, a parental absence in the face of this moment. So,
Right. It's an interesting image because after 40 plus years, I mean, it's still so shocking to see this painting. And it's just so still so powerful. But it's interesting you bring up the idea of parents and those lawn chairs sort of representing the absence of that. But I did want to ask about your mother, because I know she's a big influence in terms of your early love for art. Could you talk a little bit about your relationship with your mother?
Well, first of all, she wasn't really an influence in terms of my love of art. She was a big influence in terms of my love of creativity.
Ah.
And I make that distinction because I actually grew up in a household where there was very little art. It wasn't the kind of family that packed the kids into the car and drove off to go see a museum and on a weekend or a concert, et cetera, et cetera. It was something that was really the, whatever sort of artistic kind of objects were in the house were really meant to signify a sophistication that actually wasn't there. But what my mother was sort of extremely smart, well-read, and passionate, highly emotional, and somebody who loved to, with me, play sort of imagination games, you know, like trying to see colors that aren't there, or act out little scenarios in a grocery store. Just whatever. And it was always kind of spontaneous and playful and whatnot. So it always made me feel like there was other approaches to reality and something that I ultimately took into the art making.
Your route to studying art was a bit circuitous, and from spending the summer of love in Haight-Ashbury to selling pool furniture and then eventually studying art in Arizona. What was that journey like?
Well, they all felt very different. Only in retrospect does it look like there might have been some undercurrent that was moving me towards where I got to. But when I was trying my best to be a hippie and looking for alternative ways of community and lifestyle and thinking, experience, etc. I wasn't even remotely thinking about art. I had no ambition and no sort of identity. I wasn't pursuing defining myself in terms of art because I hadn't ever practiced it. So I didn't know how connected I would ultimately become to it. My parents had moved to Phoenix from Long Island when I was out in San Francisco trying to pursue the hippie life. And when I burned out, I went to Phoenix to try to pull myself together. At a certain point, my father, who was frustrated with my lack of ambition, and finally was like, well, just go get a job, just anything, just get a job. And so I got a job delivering lawn furniture. And there was a guy there working part-time who was taking art classes at the community college. Mm-hmm. And we would talk. I'd never seen anyone make art. And I'd go hang out with him at his apartment while he was doing a class project or something. And we would talk about what the hell he was doing or why wasn't he doing it this way or that way. Finding myself absolutely engaged in the process, his process, as an intrusive sort of presence, because I really was going, why don't you do this? He would say, no, why don't you do it? And I was like, well, because I'm not an artist. You're the artist. You should do it. Anyway.
Was he painting? What was he doing?
He was doing a variety of things. These early classes were trying to teach you a range of possibilities. So he might be doing some weird paper mache. The thing that I remembered the most, because it was the most absurd, was gluing pieces of bread to a window pane. And we would argue, that's not art. Yes, it's art. That's not art. Is anything you want to do? No, it's not. Rembrandt's art. No, bread is art. And at some point, I definitely thought, well, if he can glue bread to a window pane, I can certainly glue bread to something else, So I enrolled at Phoenix Community College in art. I found very quickly two things I didn't know I was looking for. One was that it was the first time in my life that I could actually concentrate. And the second was that I was not afraid of being alone as long as I was in this place making something and concentrating on making it. And those two things made me feel so integrated as a person, my person, that I thought, well, even if I suck at art, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life. And
wow.
Committed to, just trying to get better.
Huh.
You've talked about how painting's a very intuitive process for you. And for example, your first bed painting that you painted while you were studying in Arizona, which ultimately you describe as coming out of a temper tantrum. And there's this process of discovery, both in making and viewing your work. Can you talk a little bit about the intuitive process and what you've learned from that over the years?
It took me a few years to discover that I wasn't particularly good at abstraction, that I always had a kind of narrative, associational narrative kind of component to the making of things, which got in the way of just letting go and letting the paint take me where it would, et cetera, abstractly. And when I started to work with imagery, what I found is a very easy fluidity. What I found was that I work associationally, and I work associationally triggered by body language. And I see somebody doing something, that whatever they're doing in terms of what they're actually doing is of no interest to me. what I see them doing is moving their body in a highly suggestive way that triggers a narrative for me. And it's not explicit at first why I was looking at this person, this woman, turning her upper torso in a certain way, back to me, turning in a certain way. I'm riveted by it. And so I put that on the canvas, or I put that into a collage. And when Photoshop came along, I started to do all my prep stuff in Photoshop. But whatever it is, I start with this thing that I don't know, but I find it riveting and suggestive. So then it's a matter of, okay, here's this woman turning. Is she turning towards something, or is she turning away from it? Is she turning because somebody's just entered a room, or is she turned because her dog is barking? What is it that might be triggering this? And so I go through a series of images trying to answer a simple question like that. Oh, she's turning towards something because somebody's just entered the room. Who is that person? Find somebody that seems like that's the person that could come in. What's going on here? Is it a good thing, a good moment, bad moment? Is it an interruption? Is it, you know, so as you can hear, I'm just talking to myself and finding things that kind of locate where my search is trying to go. And at some point, it all clicks. And there's a reason why this moment becomes significant rather than banal. That's when I realize how to finish the painting. That's how I know, oh yes, this is actually it. Now I just need to make sure I get the light right, or get the bed right, or get the dog right, or whatever it is. But now I know what it is, and it goes from there.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. So that bed painting, it did become a recurring theme in a lot of your work, and that one helped you get into CalArts.
Now we're trying to, CalArts was in the early 70s, 70 to 72.
For me, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But right before, you were very open about this in your memoir, Bad Boy. Right before you were to begin classes, your mother passed, and it was a suicide. I mean, this tremendous loss is such a transitional moment in your life where you're finding out what you want to do, and you're there at this amazing place. How did you, I don't even know how to ask this, how did you deal with that tremendous blow? I mean, that I can't imagine.
Well, obviously suicide in a family is a profound and wounding and complicated experience. So it wasn't, especially during that time, where there wasn't the sort of public space in which you could examine, share feelings on a big, you know, open level. It seems now there's more of an acceptance of therapies and support groups and, you know, all those kind of things that might have helped deal with it. So for me, it was about repression and sort of just burying it as far and deep as I could, and which I did pretty good until I began to work with imagery and began, you know, figuration, and began to work with the suburbs, began to work with the content that came out of that. And then, of course, the themes of my life were present and explicit. So it's funny when, even though it's not funny, but it's funny in that people often ask me about my memoir, what was the most difficult thing to write about him? Assuming that I would say, oh God, it was, you know, my dysfunctional family, my mother's suicide, da, 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 da. But I'd been actually painting that for 40 years. So for me, it was, that wasn't the painful, but the painful was realizing that the art world had become a place that I didn't sign up for, I didn't recognize, I don't admire. That was at that time to actually voice that disappointment was the hardest thing to express, because it was a renewal of a kind of feeling of profound disappointment.
When did that disappointment, can you pinpoint when that started? Was there a moment? I'm just curious.
It's not a moment. It was a flow. And it was something that I really feel none of us saw the consequences of what we were doing. The late 70s, early 80s was crazy time. It was fantastic. It was groundbreaking. And it was something that we couldn't see the door that we had opened would take us to this other place. Just to give you a more specific set of examples, what happened when the door opened to, in the art world, to pluralism, you had just a breaking dam of creative people, creative language, stylistic, material, et cetera, et cetera. Every form of expression became as good as any other form. So there was no hierarchical structure there anymore. The art world itself wasn't ready for it, even though they couldn't control it or stop it. They weren't institutionally ready for it. Prior to that moment, there was a handful of galleries in New York, and those handful of galleries were known as stables, right? That was a very popular way of talking about the gallery is who their stable of artists were. The reason they could be called stables was because everybody knew that within this gallery, there was this kind of art done by these artists. And in that gallery, there was a totally different kind of art. There was no mixing of the genres and the stylistic stuff. It was minimalism was here, pop art was here, photography was here, et cetera.
And you and your colleagues were referred to as the neo-expressionists, right? At the Mary Boone stable,
yes.
I suppose.
Yeah. Well, yes, except that Mary's gallery was transitioning into a group of artists of which I was a part of, but she was showing other kinds of art at the same time. And neo-expressionism was only one small aspect of the kind of art that was going on at the time. There was all kinds of feminist critique. There was racial and sexual identity art that was being done in a variety of languages, from installation, performance, painting, photography, blah, blah, blah. It was all those things were happening. And the museums would do shows that their idea of a current show was a show that they could plan and do scholarship on, heavy curation over 3 or 4 years, and then do the show. Art magazines could do long articles, scholarly or thoughtful journalism, 6 months out, something published. So it wasn't connected directly to a blurb about a show. This curators and galleries and everything, all of a sudden there was just this rush to try to capture as much of what was going on as possible. And as a result, the structure changed. There were first alternative spaces cropped up, which were essentially sort of almost like nonprofit organizations that showed the young, hot artists, tried to sort of formulate, make sense out of what was going on. There was all of a sudden a lot of galleries popped up trying to capture the spillover from the other galleries that couldn't handle the quantity of art that was now out there. The collectors were a different group of collectors. They were younger, flush with dot-com money or Wall Street boom money, coming in and looking for young artists that are going to turn out to be Jasper Johns or Picasso or something like that. So there was a speculative market showed up. There was this sort of sense of artist lifestyle. And so it was glamorous. And partly it got that way because the only thing that could handle the coverage of what was going on in this moment in the art world was daily newspapers and weekly magazines. And all of a sudden, artists started showing up in the same places that movie stars, rock stars, celebrities showed up and gave an aura to the art world, to the artists in the art world that was about that.
Right, right.
The limousines start showing up as a way of getting your hot new artists to their first opening and going out and finally somebody inviting you to have an incredible meal with $1,000 bottle of wine. But just like, how could you say no to any of that? Right. It was like,
and how do you keep up so with much, all of that?
Well, that's the thing. First of all, you're either pulled up into it. So for a brief period of time, if you're hot, it's easy. You're just swept up in it.
Yeah.
If you're struggling to get swept up into it, it's a nightmare. And if you're fading from glory, it's also a nightmare, right? So it's something that you think you've got some control over. You have much less control than you think you do. If you're caught up in it, you'd be foolish not to taste it. You know, you'd be foolish right. not to go, yeah, what's it like to show up at a red carpet event? You know, I have zero idea. This would be fun. Mm-hmm. And once or twice, it's fun. And then it's not. And then it's boring. And then it's stupid. And then it's, you know, all the other non-life sustaining things. And anyway, it was something where that was the beginning of it. Now, what we didn't know that that's what we were doing, that we were solidifying that relationship of art and artist to spectacle, to privilege, to lifestyle, et cetera. We thought, actually, if you look at the art that most of us were making, we were trying to tear the temple down. Mm-hmm. And that is something that the sort of political, historical ambition of our work was absolutely about. There's a failure at the heart of our culture that we've inherited and we're looking at and we're dealing with and stuff. And at the same time, we're feeding an audience that likes the aura around badness and angriness and whatever, the craziness, etc., but has no interest in actually dealing with the content of it. So
what's interesting, you know, you talk about wanting to tear down the temple, and a lot of the artists that were in this, in the Mary Boone stable with you that were doing that, you know, you came, you know, I just want to go back to CalArts, because in the early 70s, that's exactly what everybody was trying to do. Baldessari was there, Judy Chicago, Alan Capro. I want to go back because I think it's important to talk about that time and what you gained from being in such a radical environment, especially as you were pursuing painting, which probably people then consider dead. So it's just, to me, this is all sort of connected. I'm just curious about how that time informed what was to come.
To a large extent, it certainly created the foundation for radicality of art engagement, right? Mm-hmm. And to some extent, the politics, the political critique was a part of it. There was also very much a belief, the atmosphere of CalArts was that everybody that was there because they were special, that this was a place where highly selective, precocious talent arrived. The great experience, one you could only have once, and I was fortunate enough to have it, was to arrive at a learning institution that was presenting itself as visionary in terms of how one is educated, what is the engagement of knowledge and practice, etc. It was also an institution that hadn't existed prior to you stepping onto its grounds. So everybody there bought the dream. Everybody there didn't know everybody else. So there were no history, no cliques, no legacies, nothing to live up to other than what we were going to create moving forward, right? Mm-hmm. And so there was this incredible openness and enthusiasm. And because of the visionary aspect of CalArts, which is you put all the arts under one roof, right? This is not a painting or a visual arts school. This is not a dance school. This is all of it. And you put them under one roof because you're thinking they're all going to feed each other and feed off each other. And they're going to find moments of collaboration or moments of cross-pollination, et cetera, that would be engaging, expansive, and uplifting. And all of that was true. But it was also something where they wanted you to, they believed in this idea of the new, which they believed couldn't come from knowing anything about the old. So no history was taught, no traditional techniques were taught. This is within the visual arts school.
Right.
The pressure was to, and the urgency was to get people who were attached to the traditional modes of art making, the painting and sort of modeling sculptures, blah, 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 get them out of there and onto the radical, the new. So it was get them into video, get them into performance, get them into installation, get them into conceptual art. That was the pressure.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and John Baldessari at the time was sort of one of the leaders of that faction, correct? The more conceptual. And as Alex said, was that frustrating for you because you were sort of following the other direction with continuing to paint and enlivening painting?
Yeah. Well, I never studied with John, even though he was ubiquitous. And John was an incredibly generous spirit as well. So he didn't have sort of a hard-edged, judgmental thing about painting, non-painting, this, that, whatever. It was like he was more interested in how you would undermine whatever it is you were thinking within the genre that you have chosen, how you were disruptive in your own way of doing it. And I think a primary thing, he was very much a clown in the greatest sense of what a clown is. He was the irreverence, the parody, the really sort of taking on manners and beliefs and things like that. So I never studied with him per se, but he was present. And I certainly, a lot of the people that were my friends were working with him and stuff like that. And I could see the way they were trying to digest his influences and stuff. There were other people of radical thinking very much there as well. There were Wolfgang von Sterkel, who was a young German artist, performance-based and video-based artist. I took a video class from him. Alan Kaprow was very present, and Alan Kaprow was certainly somebody that had set the tone of kind of avant-garde thinking. There was the concrete poet Emmett Williams. There was Simone Forti and several people whose names I'm blanking now, who are part of the Fluxus group, which was a sort of post-Dada radical group. Joseph Beuys was actually connected to them. A lot of radical personalities that were there and came through there and stuff. And that was true in all of the different medias, who came through as composers or filmmakers or theater people, et cetera, dance, all had that same quality to them. So it was quite radical, quite questioning, which definitely made it difficult to go back into the painting studio and try to figure out just what the hell you're doing. It also made you tougher, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it seems like you stuck to it and had determination to just go with what you were doing.
What I discovered and what I believe to be true is that you don't choose to be a painter. Mm-hmm. You just choose to get better at it. The reason you don't choose to be a painter is that painters have a very specific, very particular, very difficult to define relationship to the process and the materiality of painting, that there's something about the extended hand, the touch that the painter gets from an extended reach. There's something about the smell of the materials. There's something about the feel of either resistance or smoothness or fluidity or whatever that they attach themselves to. The shapes, the colors, the luminosity or the deadness, the surface, all those things are part of the language of painting, are things that the painter attaches themselves to because it unlocks feeling and thought. It unlocks memory. It unlocks all of these sort of memories and experiences of our lives. It unlocks it, but in a controllable way. We can actually organize the chaos in a rectangle with colors and edges and shapes and this and that that actually makes sense of it all.
Right.
And so you don't choose to do that. What you do is you realize this is how you receive and articulate experience and information.
Right, right. Now, it's interesting because you were talking about in Arizona having that revelation that, you know, having that concentration and being able to be alone, and then here being thrust in this environment where there are happenings and there's all this everything going on, and it sort of probably made you stronger as a painter because you had to sort of consciously bypass all those distractions to really get to the heart of it and what you wanted to do.
One of the things that, you know, was painful but very positive was because those of us who painted and tried to paint, of course, we were trying to embrace the most recent aspect of painting, whether it was large abstract field painting or process-based painting or hard edge painting, whatever it was always within the language of abstraction, was at least more tolerable than figuration. But we would have these critiques, and they were brutal, brutal critiques. And part of the brutality came from, you know, trying to believe that truth within what we were doing was so important that it kept the medium alive. As students critiquing other students, we would try to destroy each other. We would try to find where that veered from the truth of it, where you were lying to yourself, or you're trying to get away with something. We inflicted a tremendous amount of pain on on each other. But it actually, again, was something that came from saying, no, this thing that we're doing isn't dead. It's very much alive, because look at how painful it is what we're doing, right? So there was that. And my resume says I was at CalArts from 1970 to 1972. The great thing about CalArts was you could get your degree whenever you wanted to. So it wasn't attached to a specific length of time. There were certain requirements you had to have done, which I had done prior to getting to CalArts. So I could have come in and left a week later and still gotten a BFA. As it turned out, I left in, I think, March of the following year. So I was at CalArts about a year and a few months. Mm-hmm. the reason that I left was I couldn't take it anymore. I had no desire to go to graduate school. I wasn't looking to put a portfolio together. My work was in a state of upheaval. I actually began to leave abstraction and play around with imagery in the final months, feeling like I was absolutely breaking every rule that the school had set up and stuff like that. So finally, the sheer pressure of that place became too much, and I fled. They gave me, very nicely gave me my BFA, mailed me my BFA, and I was gone.
And where did you go?
I went to Chicago. I was terrified of going to New York because I knew that I wasn't ready to go to New York. If I had shown up in New York in the state that I was in, which is, I would have been destroyed in a very short period of time. And so I went to a place that I thought would train me to live in a city, but without the pressures of New York. It wouldn't be as much of a pressure cooker. And I was right. Chicago was an incredible place to go, to begin to breathe, to begin to expand curiosities, to begin to experiment, and to be in an environment, a healthy environment of creative people who also had a kind of ease of socialness about them. Mm-hmm. They weren't killing each other in critiques over what the hell everyone was doing. So,
yeah, and it's a great art city, the Art Institute and the MC.
Yeah, and I was very fortunate. I lucked into a job, not right away, but at one point I lucked into a job as being a museum guard at the Museum of Contemporary Art, which at that time was a very small mom and pop. I think there were like 14 people working there kind of thing and doing these amazing shows. And the board of trustees that were there were very generous to the staff in terms of letting them come to their houses to see their incredible collections and stuff. So there was like, Chicago is very much an art place. And between that and the Art Institute, it was a great revitalization for me.
And you had a history that you could delve into where CalArts wouldn't let you.
Yeah. Yeah, that was there. And also the dominant local form of art making was the Harry Who, which were these kind of fabulous, incredibly gifted, both technically as well as gifted in their vulgarity and their humor, made these just absolutely transgressive works that were full of life. It was funny at CalArts, they were so focused on New York as the only meaningful destination for anything that if you liked any LA artists, San Francisco artists, Chicago artists, you were ridiculed because they were all seen as provincial. And of course, nowadays, if you go into any New York gallery, all you see is the influence that those different places had on the art making today.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that Harry Who, I really didn't know much about until I read your book. And then I just sort of did a deep dive, but a lot of that taboo imagery, it's funny to see how that sort of bravery that they had in their work shows up in your work eventually. And I think that that's an interesting idea of sort of discovering them while you're in Chicago. And just, I'm curious how they influenced you in terms of what you saw as being possible in your work.
Yeah, I would say that stylistically, they weren't. I tried my hand a little bit at trying to make images in a semi-cartoonish kind of way and kind of thing. But I was not good at that at all. But in terms of seeing, again, the transgressive nature and the sort of willful and spirited transgressive nature of their work, and that all sort of revolved around the body. Not only the body, but sexuality and sexual identity in relationship to the body and stuff like that. it was liberating.
You talk a lot about the body and how today the body is very alienated from art, and yet the body has been so important throughout your work. Can you talk about that a little bit and what you see in a world where self-mutilation today is considered art?
Isn't that the wildest thing?
Yep.
Yeah, how did we get here? That's the question. How did we get here, and why is it that one assumes that the struggle with the body is that it constantly reminding you that it's not going to live forever, and that your spirit, whatever that means, is trapped inside this body that has profound limitations. It can't run as fast as you can imagine running. It can't really fly. It can't hear the smallest or most intimate kind of sounds. Can't do so many things, and yet you're stuck inside this thing. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. But what I don't understand is people wanting to just get rid of it. Mm. Because to me, I don't understand life if it's about getting rid of the body as opposed to trying to come to terms with the body. It was important to me. But when you look at the how we got here, that's just that should be everyone's kind of meditation. We haven't quite figured out how to get back to the body. For me, it's important to stay with the body, as disappointing as it is.
Let's take things back a little bit. You went on from Chicago to teach at Nova Scotia School of Art and Design in the 70s, where you actually met artist April Gornick, your life partner and now wife. When you were both still in early development as artists, what was it that sparked your interest in April and each other as artists and as human beings?
April was a student at the school. She was in her senior year, and she was the most beautiful girl in the school. And the winters in Nova Scotia are very long. and this was a sort of pre-cancel culture period of time where there was hanky-panky and stuff. So my initial thing wasn't that I was attracted to her because of her brilliance as an artist. That was yet to come. Mm-hmm. But it was her as a beautiful, sexy young woman. I was 5 years older than she was, so it was not completely inappropriate, but anyway, so that was it. And at the time that I met April, she was doing nothing like what she ultimately came to do. You could see it right away, her intelligence and her commitment to art. She wasn't going to go away from that, which was exciting as well. But she was in a space where she was heavily influenced by the neo-conceptualist kind of stuff, language-based, non-imagistic, pretty obscure references and whatever. There wasn't anything that interested me at all. After she graduated and we were living together, she did some pieces, still kind of conceptual in their approach, which was to paint these pieces of wood that were milled pieces of wood, store-bought, with colors. And at one point, she started stacking a few of them. And what she painted was a landscape. It was loosely identified as that, but it had some cloud forms in it, and it was luminous. And it was luminous in a way that she never had seen before in herself, nor had I seen in art in general, this quality of glow that came from this object. She was just incredibly compelled by it, and it began to move her, rightfully so, into embracing the source of it, which was nature and landscape specific, but nature based, but also not depicting as a pictorial, picturesque experience, but understanding nature as a kind of spiritual force, a kind of, it wasn't landscape per se, it was the force of nature. And then she just exploded from that into the beauty and clarity of her work.
Yeah, her paintings were magnificent. From there, you made your way to New York with some shows.
She made me come to New York.
She did.
Yeah, we were both leaving, wanting to get out of Halifax. We'd had it. But again, I was still trepidatious about New York and the New York scene, et cetera. So I was like, why don't we go to Montreal? And she was like, you go to Montreal. I'm going to New York. And I was like, okay, we're going to New York.
And you made a huge splash in New York. And I wanted to talk about your painting Bad Boy from 1981, because I guess you got to New York, what, in around 78?
Yeah.
And then by 1981, Bad Boy, which is the same title as your memoir, is really your most notorious painting to date. And it touches upon incest and voyeurism. And you say in your memoir that before Bad Boy, you were viewed as just another up-and-coming artist, one New York solo show and a day job creating art. And afterwards, you became known as that sex painter from the suburbs.
Psychosexual.
Yes.
That's different.
Your psychosexual paintings. Can you talk to us a little bit about Bad Boy and describe that painting for us and your process?
Well, again, to reiterate, I don't think when I make paintings, I choose something and begin to associate and tell myself stories and blah, blah, blah. And Bad Boy probably was the most circuitous route to its conclusion that I'd journeyed on in my process. So it wasn't like a clear linear thinking. The impetus for exploring dangerous subject matter came from the moment that what was going on in the late 70s, trying to reassert painting as a legitimate, viable, a significant, historically alive medium. And along with that, trying to assert imagery as part of that language and stuff. And so a lot of my peers were playing around with ways of making paintings that, even though they weren't sure that it was true that painting wasn't dead, they were going to try to see if they could make something that still moved when you kicked it. And so a lot of them were looking for sensational imagery that already carried with it a kind of response, whether it was painting a portrait of Hitler or looking at pornography or things along those lines that were something where you knew it didn't matter how you painted it, the imagery carried its own sort of weight. And in fact, ironically, most of my generation, like myself, was untrained in painting, even though they painted. We were not trained in a traditional sense of learning from the model, learning from different painting techniques, et cetera, historical, traditional. We were just, here's paint, go paint kind of thing. So there was a whole lot of people, including myself, that actually were painting in earnest without being in control of the medium. And so part of painting Bad Boy came out of that, sort of going along with that thing that was out there among my peers, which was go for something sensational, go for something that on some level it could be shitty in terms of the way it's painted, but at least it carries some kind of significance. Sleepwalker actually preceded
right.
Bad Boy and actually opened the door for the possibility of Bad Boy. And by that, what I mean is what Sleepwalker did was show me the language of intimacy and the look of intimacy and the look of complexity within that for emotional, psychological kind of content. So when I went to do Bad Boy, one, I didn't think of it as Bad Boy. One, the boy wasn't even in the painting. The woman at first wasn't alone. I painted a background that was a certain kind of greenish color, and I put a bamboo curtain in, and the color of the green and the way the light was in the bamboo made me think of the adobe houses in Phoenix, where the walls are 2 feet thick, and so it's 120 degrees outside and it's 70 degrees inside. And so there was something about that that made me think of siestas, and it made me think of this, okay, this is a bedroom. And so I put the bed in there. When I put the bed in there, it became, of course, are they sleeping? Who's in there? Is it a man, a woman? Is it anybody? And I began to answer that. It's a man and a woman. At first, it was a kind of thinking of it as a post-coital moment. Whatever it was, I couldn't make the guy be there. I found early on that if someone's not supposed to be in my work, I actually can't paint them right. So they have to leave. And so I couldn't get this guy in there in a way that he deserved to stay. So he left. And her position initially was in relationship to him, but now he's gone. Now that doesn't make sense. So I flipped her over. But I kept thinking, you know, there's somebody else in this room and she's not alone. And so I put a baby on the pillow next to her head. That didn't work. Then I put a 5-year-old kid sitting on the edge of the bed, sort of separating the bamboo curtains to look outside. That didn't work. And then finally, I painted this kid, this 8-10-year-old, whatever he is, boy, seen from behind so that we're seeing what he's seeing. And we're looking over his shoulder, what he's looking at, which is he's looking at a mature woman who's exposing herself to him. It took me a while to figure out that not only was he watching her, but he was stealing something. And I sort of changed his arm position to be now reaching behind his back and sort of going through the purse that was on the table and stealing something. And I was convinced when I showed it that I was going to have to leave town, that I was going to be asked to leave town. Might not even be asked. I might have been ridden out of town, especially by feminists who, where their critique was very boisterous at that time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, I'm just going to get killed for this. And instead, the opposite happened. I was embraced and I was lauded, and it was a totally other than what I'd expected. So,
well, this is sort of the moment where I've been waiting to ask, because I think with Bad Boy, you were sort of catapulted, and with a lot of those paintings in that time, you were catapulted to this celebrity status, I have to say. And it was also David and Ross and Julian. What was that like to be at that point where you weren't sure what you were doing, to discovering this new voice, and then all of a sudden being at the top of the art world? It was almost like with Pollock when he was put on Life magazine. I mean, to be at that level where people everywhere knew who you were, what
was
that?
Well, you were on the cover of Vanity Fair, I think, at the time.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. The same sort of level of celebrity. And that was, I'm just so curious what that felt like.
Well, good. It felt cool.
Maybe it's an obvious question, but.
Well, no, I don't think it is the question. The question is, what do you do with it?
Hmm.
Right? What is the privilege of it. And the privilege of it, the way I took it, was that my responsibility as an artist was to first clarify for myself what my reason for being an artist is, what my definition of art is, et cetera, how I capture it in a way that compels, connects to and compels others. That's the process. That's the ambition. And then the success is something that I took to mean permission and obligation. Now I had an audience, and I had an audience that I wanted to believe. I had turned their heads and they had engaged what I was doing in the way that I wanted to be engaged, and didn't want them to tell me from then on, could you do another bad boy painting? Could you do another beach painting? In other words, I didn't want them to tell me before I showed them the journey that I was on. And so my success gave me permission to pursue that goal, knowing that I didn't have to take commissions or listen to my dealer say, why don't you make another one of those? We could sell it for a fortune, you know, whatever, which, you know, dealers are obliged to do, I guess. But I knew that I could continue to go on the journey that I was on with the hope that I could continue to interest them, that they were now going to follow me. They're going to see what I was doing next. What was Eric up to now, et cetera, et cetera. I understood the success. The celebrity, I didn't embrace in a particularly interesting way, I don't think. I didn't assume celebrity. It's one thing, it's certainly a pleasure to be recognized by people that you don't know, but who seem to know you or know you in a certain way, and they like what you do. And so that kind of affirmation is very nice to have. But to be just a cipher for lifestyle or success or something like that, just some empty icon of meaning, is terrifying to me. And so I didn't go that route. Plus, I'm so middle class. It's like I don't have style. I don't have that level of sophistication, or so I couldn't pull celebrity off if I tried. So
after this riding the wave of the 80s, in the 90s, you said something that I thought was interesting. You said by the 90s, one could declare that the age of anxiety was officially over. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you meant? It was in the context, I think, of art history and the trajectory of 20th century art.
Well, I came out of teachers, artists that had either been part of the abstract expressionist post-World War II anxiety, existential, everything wrapped up in the gesture and the authenticity of brushstroke, a level of violence, a level of disruption, compositional disruption, that kind of thing, the aggressively handled object. And it was something that thrilled me because it had such importance to it. It felt like painting, being an artist, was heroic. And I love that idea. And I remember one day I went into, I don't know whether it was Jeffrey Deitch, and now I'm actually blanking on the name of the artist, the woman, which I apologize to her in advance because I can't remember her name right now. She was doing these paintings that were sort of a thin wash, monochrome surface of color. And then these incredible white, thin-lined, narrowing and expanding in a calligraphic way, arabesque curlicues, almost like the kind of someone practicing the cursive form of calligraphy, right? And I was looking at them, and there were two things. One was that you can't make that kind of set of shapes, that kind of fluid thing, if you were dealing with an overtly expressive existential problem, right? Couldn't express anger or frustration or fear or blah, blah, blah in those overt ways. And the other thing was that when I looked closely at the work, these weren't drawn lines, curlicues. They were actually etched, scratched out of this hard surface. So they were like insanely controlled. Mm-hmm. they were like something where you think this took so long and had to be so perfect to scratch, 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 scratch into the, you know, razor thin lines. This thing that at first appeared to be free of that, to be confidently curlicuing around the surface, that sort of brought to the foreground this thing of repression. And all of that combination of control and repression made me realize that in terms of the language that we'd come up to that point in expressing anxiety, that no longer existed. This was the new form of expression of anxiety, which was to not express it, to behave it, but not express it, right? Mm-hmm. Which is very different.
I just want to talk about your sculpture for a second. Specifically, we're talking about this new era, and I think to sort of take that idea of the flip side, the viewer, and let's talk about Tumbling Woman, which is a work that you made following the September 11th attacks. And it was a way, I think, for you to make sense of what happened as a New Yorker, as a human being, and also memorialize people that were lost. And I'm curious about that piece, but also the reaction to it. It's sort of in this regard of this sort of new era, because I think that this is an interesting way of sort of flipping what you were just saying. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I experienced 9/11 pretty much the same way most of us did, which is to say that I wasn't in New York at the time. I was out on Long Island. And so I saw it unfold on TV like the rest of the world did. But while I was watching this horrific event, and also knowing that a friend of mine worked in that building, and I didn't know whether he was in there that day or not, and it turned out he was, and he perished in the tragedy, there was the experience of watching these towers come down, the destruction of it, knowing that there were so many people inside that were being pulverized by it, was absolutely unfathomably horrific. And it made me feel like this is a moment that artists are going to be needed, because one thing that artists have the gift to do, the sensibility and the gift to do, is to order chaos and to be able to sort of deal with complex, contradictory emotions and stuff like that in a way. And so I thought, if artists were ever needed, this would be the moment that we would be needed, because this is on that scale of horror and terror. In that moment, I started to think, well, what would that be? And you saw these images that you knew in themselves, they're the iconic memory of this event. The strange I-beam structures that formed crosses against the billowing clouds of dust and stuff like that. The people who had jumped or fell from the building were certainly and images you would never get out of your mind once you saw them. And they even though they censored those images in the United States, they censored them within like 10 minutes of the first broadcast of it. If you saw it, you wouldn't get that out of your mind. And that was certainly the thing that was going to tell you exactly how horrible the experience was to those who suffered it. Anyway, what I saw in terms of what really upset me was how quickly the sort of conversations around how to memorialize this place, how to honor it, how to deal with the loss and stuff, turned to a language of architecture. It was about, do we save or not save the literal footprints of the buildings? Do we declare those the representational of the sacred space? Do we shoot lights up into the sky that imitate the towers? Do we rebuild the towers taller, stronger, showing that we're unbeatable, we won't be cowed, et cetera? Whatever it was, it went on that way. And all the time, not in any way sort of acknowledging in a communal way. I mean, certainly historically, they would mention that 3,000 people died, but not in a community way of really staying attached to the people that died.
Right.
And that was the thing that I thought, well, this is the body mm-hmm. has to be reasserted into the mourning language. Hmm. We have to understand that it's really not about the buildings. Those are replaceable. What it was that there were these people, these souls, these loved ones that were destroyed. And we need to find a way to stay connected mm-hmm. to them. And so that's when I began to sort of try to find a way of expressing something through the body, and Tumbling Woman appeared.
I think you did it in such a beautiful way. And I think the emotion behind it and choosing a woman as the subject and even the title, I mean, it was, you did it very sensitively and very elegantly. And I think it was lost in a lot of people. I don't know, were you disappointed in the reaction from some people that they censored it?
More than disappointed, I was hurt.
Yeah.
The one thing, if you spend your life struggling to be clear, that you believe that clarity of expression, of articulation, whatever, is the ultimate goal, to be misunderstood is the worst thing that can happen to you. And that's what happened. There was a horrifically nasty article by a woman, a journalist, who clearly in the writing of it, she had actually never seen the piece physically. She was doing it from a photograph and made too many stupid assumptions about it. But she took the position that I was trying to make a career move on the backs of those who had suffered terrible loss, which is the worst thing you could say to me or to anybody. Anyway, but it caused a sort of firestorm, a backlash, where people didn't want to see this. They didn't want to remember this. They didn't, you know, whatever it was. And it got to the point in a very, you know, it was 3 days in a public view, and then it was taken away, because Rockefeller Center was getting bomb threats and stuff. So,
wow. It just goes back to the idea of showing what collectively we may not want to look at. It seems like you've been doing that your entire career as a painter, as a sculptor. I don't know. To me, the reaction makes sense, but I think it came out of a place of just, again, this collective space of not wanting to deal with a reality in this.
It doesn't make sense to me, though. It's so dehumanizing to not want to deal with the reality. But I think it is a cultural thing that we sort of haven't learned to.
I think that the, you know, the interesting thing about Bad Boy mm-hmm. was it was perfectly timed, mm-hmm. which is not something that I was aware of. It was something that became clear when it was embraced, the way it was embraced. What was clear to me about Tumbling Woman was that it was too soon. And I had misread something, or I had misbelieved something. I had had the privilege, why was it even considered a privilege, but I had been living with the articulation of this body and all of my feelings and thoughts about loss and terror and stuff like that, damage done. I'd been living with it for a year, making the piece. So I actually had gone through a grieving process. I didn't realize that I had done that. So when I made it public, I wasn't taking me back to the rawest moment, but clearly I was taking a public back there, and in a way that I was not wanting to. I was wanting this to be somewhat comforting or connecting to something that felt I'd extended the arm of the figures with the hand slightly open so that people might touch it, grab it, hold on to it for a brief moment, you know, something to connect. But because they hadn't been dealing with the terror that we all have of that kind of horrible ending. The thing is, now the piece is referenced all the time. So it's found its place in the language of that experience, even though it was removed. And on the 15th anniversary, they actually showed it at the museum, the 9/11 museum. So it kind of found its own time and place.
That's really kind of wild and interesting. Yeah,
it was certainly a lesson for me.
Mm. So your project that you conceived, America Now and Here, was also a way of gathering artists and looking at the role of the artist to create dialogue through art. Can you talk just a little bit about your impetus in creating this project?
Yes.
And yeah. In a way, we almost need it more than ever today. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So the series of events that you could see after 9/11, the country spun off its axis and started to really wobble and shrink into smaller and smaller groups, tribal groups, et cetera. By 2007, it was explicit that the damage that 9/11 had caused had really taken hold. And one of the things that had dismayed me with the event of 9/11 was that the country, the churches, the civic organizations, nobody was turning to artists to help them deal with the complex experience that we had just suffered through. They weren't turning to poets to write about it or filmmakers or whatever. It just wasn't something that they were going, please give us handhold, give us language, give us something to pull us together so we could share in our grief and terror. And so I thought, well, if they're not going to ask us, I'm going to ask us. You know? So I created this idea that what we need to do is bring art deeper into the community, into people's lives in a way that is less intimidating and elitist, et cetera, et cetera. So I saw that they started making these mobile trucks that could pull into a place and unfold in this way that created either a stage or a product placement sale thing, or could actually turn into a gallery. And in fact, if you put four of them together, they could connect to each other. And in a parking lot somewhere in the middle of the country, you could have a 4,000 square foot museum, and it could roll in one day and set itself up like the circus had come to town, put its banners out and unfold and do all this stuff that people would be going, what's going on in there? Let's go see, right? Yeah. This is cool. Here we are in a Walmart parking lot with this weird thing going on. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I wanted was that I wanted people to feel that before they walk in the door, that they're going to walk into something they already know a lot about. They're going to walk into something they have a lot of feelings about. And in this case, the thing that they knew about and felt about was their country, was America. Mm-hmm. So I went out and I asked a bunch of artists. My feeling was, this is a crisis moment. let's go to those generally regarded as America's best. And so I asked America's best artist to help me out. Having come from Cal Arts, the idea that the arts is all the arts, I reached out to poets and playwrights and musicians and filmmakers and everybody to we're going to put on a big show here. I asked them to give me something, either make something or give me something that was their idea or something they wanted to share, actually is the way I phrase it, something you want to share with us about your America. And I thought, boy, am I setting myself up. They're going to just put kerosene on this fire. But I was incredibly surprised at what came out of it, because what they came back to me with was so generous. It was about their intimate America, their personal America. It sort of separated into three categories that were easily identifiable in general terms. There was America as place, as America as people, America as icon. America as people would be images of friends or your postman. Images of place could be your favorite chair or a place in the woods or an incredible desert landscape or et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, it was really quite amazing. It was the first time, I think, in contemporary art where we managed to get artists to think about the same thing at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right? As opposed to just being off doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And so it was really kind of fantastic. And the irony is, I felt like the hardest thing was going to be to ask these big shot artists to do this, that they would sort of basically say, nah, it's not my thing, or I'm too busy, or blah, blah, blah. And I thought the easiest thing was going to be to ask people with tons of dough who are big time art collectors and art supporters and basically the guardians of our culture to give us some money so that we could pull this off. And in fact, the opposite happened. The artists were absolutely, let's get this done, had jumped on it. And the money didn't come. And partly timing again is everything. The 2008, the market crashes. The last thing businesses wanted to do was to appear to support art when they had lost a ton of dough or lost a ton of dough for their investors. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't get corporate sponsorship and the kind of money that we needed to get the trucks and get them on the road. It was like a $15 million extravaganza, and we just couldn't get the money. We did a thing in Kansas City, not in trucks, but in loft spaces in an area of town that was undeveloped, just to sort of show to people that the concept worked. That then the concept, which I forgot to mention, was everywhere we went, we would get the artists who lived there to show us their America, so that we were having a dialogue about this country.
That's great.
And people in Kansas City did a fantastic job of coming up with their version of America. And it was an amazing event, amazing show, et cetera. But again, we couldn't get the money to realize it. And so that ended the America Now and Here.
And it's a shame. And I do think we need it now more than ever. And hopefully one day it can be realized.
Yeah. It also brings me hope that all these artists responded in this way. I mean, going back to your idea that artists need to be the ones shining the light on the culture and having this dialogue, it brings me hope that there was such a great response there.
Mm-hmm. For me, that was a revelatory to see that they were game for it. And also that they had incredible things to sort of say about it. But the thing was, at the core of this was that the art world has participated in separating itself from the common community, mm-hmm. you know, the everyday life of something where it would be a reflex for anybody to say, oh, I need to sort of understand this or pull out a poem that talks to them in a deep way in that moment, et cetera, or a visual experience and whatnot, that we've drifted apart in a way that is so problematic that the chaos that's here now, the craziness, the anger, the artificial divides.
Yeah.
Are something that right now we need art to show us what we share more than what makes us different, right? Mm-hmm. And so trying to find ways to break down those barriers should be all our goals,
right?
Including the artists. The time of esoteria, the time of private meanings and crap like that should be over. I mean, this right. is like, come on, we all live in the same fucking world here. Let's
let's do something about it
yeah.
and build some bridges.
Yes.
I would love for you to tell us about the church, your current project in Sag Harbor. What was your inspiration and your mission for this project?
Well, it certainly comes out of America now and here in the sense of trying to find a way of integrating the arts into community mm-hmm. in a very clear, direct, easily identifiable, easily accessible way. But the other thing is, I live in Sag Harbor, which is a remarkable town. And it's remarkable, even though it's in the Hamptons, which are less remarkable. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable because it's how it's different from the Hamptons is that it was always a town that produced something for a global market. And because it did that, it had a sense of itself in the larger world, which meant that it intuitively or inherently recognized differences. It intuitively recognized and tolerated diversity. And it became a place, a small town with a great range of diversity represented in it that were living relatively harmoniously. And it was something that began to, in the 70s, I think, the Bulova watch case, which was the last sort of product export thing, left. And then it began to move into something more similar to what the Hamptons is, which is second homes and wealth and sort of exclusive mall mentality, high-end stores, blah, 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 and a kind of suburbanization. It was killing me. I've lived in this town since 1985, and I've watched it change. And I just thought, there has to be a way of, you can't stop it, but there must be a way of slowing it down, making it interesting, bringing people to the town for the right reasons, or, you know, making it a destination rather than, you know, just for ice cream and t-shirts and walking around the main street, but for something other than that. And part of it was, at some point, I realized that, you know, there was always an arts community here from the very earliest. I always thought it was parallel to the production part of the culture, that they were there because they were tolerated, because it was a little offbeat, or they were left alone or something like that. But I began to wonder if maybe it wasn't a parallel. It was just a long intersection, which was happening now, where the arts could become the new production of this town. And when I thought of that, I thought, well, you know, first of all, young artists can't afford to live here. So we have to find a way of bringing their energy, their blood, their, you know, whatever, passions. We have to get them in there to keep it alive. And so we need places for them to work and stay. And I had started, bought a house that we used for beginnings of that. And then across the street, this church became available. And it became clear. It's like, if we're really going to do this, we need a bigger space. So I bought the church and renovated it to be a creativity center, an exhibition center, an artist residency, studios, whatever we could do in there, performance space. Again, my CalArts background, I wanted to represent all the arts. And to that extent, even though we've only been open for a little over a year, we've gotten dance and we've gotten visual art exhibitions and we've gotten theater pieces and music and stuff happening there. So it's functioning in a great early way. I can't believe how well it hit the ground running. So
that's great.
It's really exciting. And do you want to talk at all about the saints that you painted? And there's some...
Well, yeah, that's I certainly thought that, churches always put their saints in the windows, right? And so here, this was a church. Now it's an art center or an art church. Let's put our saints in the window. So I did these portraits. There were 20 in the design of the windows. We've created 20 spaces that we could put portraits in of the saints of Sag Harbor that were the creatives. And going back as early as James Fenimore Cooper and Herman Melville and moving forward to people like Gordon Mata Clark and Spalding Gray and Lanford Wilson and all kinds of greatness in between. And again, representing the diversity of the town, representing the diversity in terms of the creative output of the artists that are canonized in these windows. And at the time that I did it, I thought the qualifications were simple. They had to be dead. They had to have a direct connection to Sag Harbor, and they had to have a product that went out into a national or international cultural impact. So it was about producing greatness from a small place. I wanted to emphasize the emanation, the scale of emanation that could come out of that. Now, I thought, 20 representing great diversity, we might be fudging it here on some of these people. In the research and everything, we found that now we've probably identified at least 150 people that belong in these windows.
Wow.
And of course, because we're all aging, there are more people to come. Right now, I'm thinking that we'll do this as a, and I don't know what the timing on it will be, but that it'll be something where every now and then these first 20 leave and a new 20 show up. Then again, a new 20. And whether I do some more or whether we get another artist to do their interpretation of portraits of these artists, et cetera, we'll see. But I like the idea that we'll keep the legacy, this extraordinary legacy, artistic legacy of this town alive in this particular way. So,
I love that.
That's beautiful.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. Right?
Speaking of fun, what else? What are you working on now? What's next? What do we have to look forward to besides the saints?
And the church.
Well, I'm continuing to paint and struggling on a sculpture. Right now, I make sculptures sort of in between things, and I hadn't been working on one for a couple of years, so I was playing around with that. But I've also been doing something that I'm absolutely curious about what it's going to be, which is in the realm of the NFT digital thing that's going on now. Right after Tilt Brush came out, April bought it for me. I'd expressed interest in it. And she heard that and she bought it. Tilt Brush is a virtual paintbrush, and it's absolutely wacky.
I've used it before, and I'm just so curious how you're using it. That's amazing.
Well, it's, I'm not using it in any super sophisticated way. I'm doing what I do. I'm painting people. Because I work from photographs, I paint basically two-dimensionally, right? I don't paint the other side of the figure. I don't paint the figure in the round. And so I've been sort of doing these impressionistic gestural paintings of figures that are on a beach. And one of the things that when you look at it from the front, you see the sort of colorful articulation of a figure. The minute you move, walk through it or walk around it, it turns into like unidentifiable strips of color that are just suspended in this virtual space. And I like that as well. It's definitely not a fully three-dimensional figurative experience, but I've been talking to these people in England who have a way of mapping the figure, the brushstrokes of the figure. And then what we're talking about is that they would map it and then will digitally print it 3D. And wow. Do like bas reliefs of it.
Oh.
So I have no idea whether this is going to be really interesting or completely pathetic, but the idea of taking something that only exists as in reality only exists as X's and O's or ones or whatever it is, and somehow capture it and pull it out of that unreality and cast it into something like bronze or some metal and turn it into the most real.
Wow.
It's wacky, right?
What's the X's and O's part?
It's not, I'm just talking about digital programming, X's and ones.
Right.
You know, it's just an algorithmic formula mm-hmm. that these things exist at all. But to take that and actually concretize it in this way is, it's so counterintuitive that it's kind of exciting.
It's like a 3D printing, I guess, what it is. Like,
well, that's where they're going with it. They're going to 3D print it, and then we'll see. I mean, you know, we'll 3D print it, then paint it, and et cetera, et cetera. How they can attach it to each brushstroke get attached, and I have no idea, but that's what we're working on now.
Wow. I can't wait.
Pretty fascinating. I mean, it's like a wild merger of art and technology.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about tilt brush is it's a totally primitive painting tool. It was designed really as entertainment for kids and novices or something who were wowed by this sort of playful thing. It actually can't do in a sophisticated way all the painting itself can do. Like it doesn't have transparencies. It doesn't blend. It doesn't smear and you can't erase a gesture and shape it at the same time. It's like you erase it and the whole thing goes away. So it has a lot to be desired in terms of working with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, it's its own thing. And that's kind of fabulous in itself.
That's great. That's great.
What do you do with it?
I used it. So I used it because a friend of mine had it, but I also tried it again at AT&T, had this conference on technology, and they had used it in the context of Disney animators. There was a Disney animator that did a demonstration with it. And it was very, very interesting that we had a chance to use it ourselves. So I sort of used it in that context. And then at my friend has the Oculus and everything. Mm. So I was just really playing around with it. But the idea that you could add elements of fire and smoke and like.
Right. That's right. It gets into the doodads a lot.
It's interesting. Yeah.
But speaking of animation, I mean, the thing that I actually love the most about what I do with it is when you click on the sketch that you've made, it rebuilds itself and it rebuilds itself brushstroke by brushstroke.
Wow.
It does it too quickly for me to, I want to try to figure out how you slow that down, because to me, that's the most incredible experience because it's animation and you're like you're looking at for, you know, this period of time, you're going one brushstroke, two brushstrokes, three, four, five, six, seven. Oh my God, that's a figure. And, wow. And oh my God, there's another one. And oh, there's a tree. And, you know, it's like, it's something where it brings you into the real, how painting constructs imagery in a very sort of exciting, playful way. And I thought, well, this is what the NFT actually should be, is this precisely this animation. But I haven't yet to find somebody who actually knows how to grab the animation of it and then manipulate it in a way that can slow it down, control the time a little bit differently and stuff. So
I'm thinking just of your paintings itself, like being able to be in a room or being at a pool and being able to sort of do a 360. I mean, it's sort of made for your paintings in a lot of ways as well, because you really live in a painting when you're in this program.
Yeah, that's why I like it, is that you step into literally into the painting realm. So
that's cool.
That's
wild. Yeah. Yeah.
So
fun stuff.
Yeah. Well, at the end of this, we do this thing called the quick draw. 6 questions, 60 seconds, one word answers.
Okay, I'm really bad at this kind of stuff. I freeze, you know that.
Well, that's okay. Okay, Alex, no. Take it away.
Who are you listening to right now?
Room Full of Teeth.
What are you reading?
I'm reading The Loft Generation by Edith Schloss.
Favorite film of this past year?
The Year of the Dog and Drive My Car with Coda.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Coming in a strong third.
Did you like Licorice Pizza? I'm just curious.
I was just going to ask the same
question. Yeah, I did.
Favorite song?
I'm going to go this time with Leonard Cohen's Alexandra Leaving.
Favorite escape?
Tennis.
Favorite guilty pleasure?
Tennis.
I love it. And I can relate. Thank you so much, Eric. This has been such a joy.
Thank you. Good. Well, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Art Laws is produced by Alex Zappa and Robin Rosenfeld.
Music is by Voidcore.
And the episode you just heard was recorded in Los Angeles.
Thanks for listening to Art Laws. I'm Alex Zappa.
And I'm Robin Rosenfeld. Follow us on Instagram at Art Laws Pod.
And subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Leave a comment and give us a rating. We'll be back soon with more. Bye.